Trina, who's going to make a staff report?
Mr. Brown will be right.
Mr. Brown?
Mr. Mayor, members of council, in your materials tonight is a proposed ordinance which makes the unlawful possession of marijuana a Class 4 misdemeanor. This is offered tonight on first reading. The city does not currently have an ordinance that addresses marijuana possession. Currently, prosecutions are conducted under state law. Under state law, an initial conviction for unlawful simple possession, I'll use the term simple possession to distinguish it between from possession with intent to distribute marijuana. Under state law, it's punishable by confinement in jail for not more than 30 days or a fine of not more than $500 or both. A second or subsequent conviction under state law is punishable as a Class 1 misdemeanor. There's also a statutory procedure in Virginia for under state law for first-time offenders to obtain a dismissal of the charge without an adjudication of guilt. In a prosecution under the state law, the judge, without entering a judgment of guilt and with the consent of the accused, may defer further proceedings and place the accused on probation with terms and conditions. And if those terms and conditions are met, the court dismisses the charge. The ordinance that you have, as you have directed, makes an initial charge punishable as a Class 4 misdemeanor, which means a fine of not more than $250. It also provides, and this was my addition and mine alone, that any person upon a second or subsequent conviction is guilty of a Class 1 misdemeanor. And that was an attempt to make it consistent with state law. State law explicitly says that ordinances of this city and any other locality shall not be inconsistent with the Constitution, federal law, or state law. There are a couple of questions which I think are raised by this ordinance, and as I say, we haven't done this before, so I'm not sure I can provide you with a definitive answer. We have included a provision, and this is paragraph F of the ordinance that incorporates by reference the pre-conviction probation conditions and terms that is found under state law. Generally, a court does not take a criminal prosecution under advisement without an adjudication unless there is specific authorization to do that. What I cannot, and I've discussed this with our Commonwealth's attorney, and I'm appreciative of the time and wisdom he has shared with me on this. What's not clear is whether that would be acknowledged under a local ordinance. One of the consequences of being charged under state law, regardless of whether there's a conviction or a deferral, is a suspension of the driver's license. Again, it's not clear to me or the Commonwealth, and I'll, if you'll allow me to speak for the Commonwealth's attorney on this one point, whether there is authority for the issuance of a restricted license for someone charged under a local ordinance. You have, I guess now, two versions that have been provided to you by Mr. Fogel. The first deletes the sentence from my ordinance, which makes a second or subsequent conviction a Class 1 misdemeanor under Mr. Fogel's version. And I know he said that it's primarily for second and third offenses, and in practice that may be. It is not so limited on its face. Under his ordinance, any conviction is punishable as a Class 4 misdemeanor. And in the version that was handed out tonight, and I would defer to the Commonwealth's attorney on this point. I'm not sure I've seen a criminal statute before that gives the accused the option of choosing which law he is prosecuted under. But the version handed out tonight says, in a prosecution under this section, meaning the proposed city ordinance, the accused may elect to proceed instead under the provisions of the state code. And the reason that was inserted is that for indigent defendants, the constitutional right to court-appointed legal counsel applies when there is a possibility of incarceration. Under this ordinance, there would not be, and therefore there would be no Sixth Amendment right to court-appointed counsel as there is under state law.
Mr. Brown, I appreciate that point, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the city couldn't choose to guarantee that right.
I don't, Mr. Norris, I don't know of any authority for you to pay for private legal counsel in a criminal prosecution under a city ordinance. I just don't know where there's the authority to do that.
Mr. Brown, what's the definition of indigent legally?
In the criminal case,
I mean, in this case,
I would defer to Mr. Chapman, if I may.
Can you come up to the mic just so people at home can hear you?
Hi, Dave Chapman, Commonwealth Attorney here in Charlottesville. I'm here to answer questions that are technical in nature. There's a formula that's used here and everywhere else in the state to determine on the basis of income, dependence, and many factors whether someone is indigent or not.
That determines whether they can have the capability of hiring.
That's right.
Is it comparable to something that you can... We're just wondering who this is going to apply to, that we might recognize in terms of public housing.
We had a case, for example, just today in circuit court, in which an individual whose annual income came to about $14,000, he had several dependents, he qualified for court-appointed counsel. It's a pretty generous standard, erring in favor of appointing counsel where someone has limited means.
Actually, Mr. Chapman, while you're here, if the city were to enact this ordinance creating a local, our own local approach to marijuana, whose decision is it whether or not to prosecute under the state ordinance or the local ordinance?
It can depend. A policy can be chosen locally to do it one way or another.
Chosen by the city council or chosen by your office?
It could be determined by my office. It could be determined by the police department in their charging decisions as to which route to go. For example, with an ordinary moving traffic violation, they currently elect to use the local ordinances because of the revenue ramifications for the city. So the same kind of choice could be made in the local police department. And we would not view, that is, in my office as Commonwealth Attorney, we would not view that as a particularly important issue, choosing the one way or another, provided certain things are enabled under a local ordinance or known with certainty are not possible. And you all know what you might be recommending. In this. And let me give you a couple of examples about that. Mr. Fogel made reference to and has apparently included in a version that I have not seen the ability of the accused to elect which provision they would be prosecuted under. That's unique. It doesn't mean that it is impossible to do that. But a person who would do that in this kind of instance needs to be well informed about how to make that decision. And it's not so easy just to say, well, I want door number one or I don't want door number two. For example, if you were considering choosing being prosecuted under state law, you would be subjecting yourself to the theoretical possibility of a jail sentence that could have a ramification later if you're ever charged with another criminal offense in the future. You need to know that ramification. You could also, by making that choice, have an opportunity to have access to a restricted operator's license upon conviction, and that might be very important to you. And you would, by making that choice, for sure have the opportunity to qualify for court-appointed counsel. You would, however, subject yourself to the procedural provisions that allow, on the one hand, the minimization of court costs by foregoing The lab fee, if you, in effect, admit that the officer's field test regarding the proof of what substance it is admissible in comparison to having the substance sent off to the lab for testing, which requires, if a person is convicted, the payment of a lab fee. You'd need to know those things to make that choice intelligently. You would, on the other hand, want to know, perhaps is the experience of the young woman from earlier described about her experience in the immigration system. That's real. Let me tell you, that is real. That can happen to people. That's a collateral consequence that you might not face under the local ordinance, but we suggest for sure lose under the local ordinance your ability to have a restricted operator's license if convicted. If you're convicted under a local ordinance of possession of marijuana, the Division of Motor Vehicles is going to take your license for 6 months and you do not have access to a restricted privilege to drive. Now, in the version of the proposed ordinance I saw, there was an effort to include the ability by a statute-like provision to enable the judge to take it under advisement. If you go through probation, complete it successfully, it would be dismissed at the end of the year. That provision, 18.2-251, is the means by which you can have a restricted license. But the language of that code provision, 18.2-251, is explicit. It pertains only to convictions under this article of the state code. So with a local ordinance, in light of statutory authority, people convicted under the local ordinance would be materially disadvantaged. Now, the reason I say all those things is that to make the decision about which way to go, you need an attorney. And you can't have one until you've already made the determination to go under the state code. And we see it in court all the time. Even people who have a pretty good idea, when they come forward for a first offense marijuana case, as night follows day, if they're eligible, they're going to get the 18.2-251 program. They're going to get that if that's what they want. People hesitate and they want advice of counsel even in making that decision. Before they go anywhere, they want many times to have counsel to enable them to weigh the pros and cons for them. And it's very important for people to have expert advice at that critical juncture. So it sounds good, but it is not true that the solution is to simply let people elect which code system they would prefer to be prosecuted under. Now, there could be some avenues by which one would solve many problems, perhaps by obtaining an attorney general's opinion as to would the language of 18.2-251 be permissibly accessed under a local ordinance. I don't know what the attorney general would say. My own opinion based on the language is he would say, no, it can't be. One could ask the attorney general for an opinion about would DMV, in fact, take somebody's license if they were prosecuted and convicted under the local ordinance. There might be a different opinion than one might have about the motor vehicle code and the ramifications of a conviction like this. We cannot answer those questions with complete certainty. If one purports to be able, by enacting the versions of the ordinances that are in front of you, to answer those with complete certainty, I hope you're wrong. I hope you're right, because if not, you're going to be disadvantaging people who come before the court here. There really is a need to have certainty on several points to know what you are getting into and what people would actually go through in court.
Other questions?
I had a question. Several constituents have asked me if we could do, as a way of bypassing all of this, is do what New York City just decided to do within the last week, which is essentially they don't, if they catch somebody with small amounts of marijuana, they're not going to book them, they're not going to take them back, they're going to essentially issue them a ticket on the spot that they then need to pay. Is there any provision in state code or that would allow Charlottesville to do something similar?
Substantial discretion to make policy decisions of a wide variety, including that, exist under current law. One question one must address in reaching a decision like that is the extent to which the law becomes different in Charlottesville than it is in Tidewater, than it is in Southwest, than it is in Northern Virginia, that it is just outside the limits of Charlottesville and Albemarle County. It's a system of law, and typically law enforcement priorities have great latitude, but by in effect directing that the law not be enforced in a certain area, you need to understand what the ramifications would be. And what are they? Well, it's a policy judgment. I can tell you, because all of the certificates of analysis for testing of all kinds of drugs that gets done at the state laboratory come before our office. They all get returned to our office, so I see them all, and I know that it is, frankly, a fraction of the cases that actually get prosecuted in courts. The officers are all the time coming across paraphernalia and substance on people, and their appropriate rules require them, when they find it, to take it into their possession and account for it, and they do so by placing it in evidence and having it sent to the lab for testing. But it doesn't mean it gets prosecuted all the time. It is bad policy to put officers or anyone else out on the street taking substances that are illegal in the Commonwealth from people and disposing of them informally. It's very important as a public policy to have consistency and uniformity in accounting for any and everything that's taken from a citizen out in the field.
And how does that relate to what New York is doing in terms of that conflict?
I don't know what accounting system they might have. They may well have exactly as we do here. People need to take something into their possession, submit it into evidence, and have it tested. They may proceed informally. And all I'm suggesting is proceeding informally is bad policy.
And I wasn't really addressing that piece of it. I agree that that would need to be addressed.
Yeah.
But I was talking more about in terms of disposing of the case, of, you know, how do you proceed when you've encountered an individual who has a small portion of this substance? Is it really a good use of our resources to take them back to the police station or to get them booked, to have them then go through this entire process here? Or could we do essentially what New York is doing, which is to write them a ticket on the spot?
Frankly, we do that more
right.
often than not.
And so I guess
far.
The question is...
Yeah,
is,
we write people a summons.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the question is, what's the downside to making that our official policy?
The policy would have to anticipate cases in which there are multiple charges. The,
right.
the less serious might be
right.
marijuana, more serious might be other charges.
Absolutely.
And then there are things having to do with the likelihood that a person would actually follow through and appear in court in a summons process. They haven't been before a magistrate. They've been released on a summons.
Yeah.
There,
So it's doable, you just want to make...
It's certainly an option.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a policy option that can be available.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
Why don't you stay in if there are other questions?
If I could, Mr. Mayor, if I could just add one thing to my earlier response to Mr. Norris. We do or we can make monetary contributions to the public defender's office. That law changed a number of years ago. I believe it was a bill by Delegate Van Yeres that allowed us to do that. I don't, however, know of any authority that would allow us to pay directly cost of anyone charged with a violation of a criminal city ordinance.
So if the public defender were representing an individual, they could bill the city for that?
I don't think they bill the city. I think this is part of, you know, is part of your annual budget.
Okay.
You can make an appropriation.
Right.
And I don't know the constraints that office has on representing defendants, whether they represent anyone when there's not a possibility of jail time or not. But it's done, I think, typically as a lump sum appropriation.
And if I could get clarity on two things that bother me greatly about what I read here, and I don't claim, there's lots of shells and mays and things, so I'm not entirely sure what automatically happens, but taking driver's license away and automatic treatment, drug treatment, if you have simple possession. That involves not only probation for marijuana, but also for alcohol if you're caught with marijuana, which, I mean, it seems like the punishment far outweighs the crime. So under a local ordinance versus the state law, how do those two factors come in? I mean, when will a person who's caught with a very small amount of marijuana have their license taken away and have to go to this drug court or treatment?
It will happen when they're found guilty or when they are approved by the court to enter into the statutory program.
Does it always happen that something or do they sometimes walk away with, I mean, under our local ordinance, if you're found to possess a joint or whatever it is, is there ever a point where you'll just pay the fine and you
will... Oh, people do that all the time. People many times accept a 30-day suspended sentence, no fine. We don't take any of their money. They accept that in lieu of going down the road of having probation because, for whatever reason, that's a preferable alternative. It is very demanding, probation. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
But people routinely make that decision that perhaps for them they already don't have a license or it's not important enough to them for one reason or another. They select the option of just being found guilty. And for them, the local ordinance might work exceptionally well. It would involve probably some actual fine, but not necessarily. The judge could always suspend it.
So on the how does the record vary between those two local ordinance versus a first-time offense under state law?
The record ramifications and I'm not sure I'm completely able to answer that question. And the reason why it will depend in part on whether or not they're processed as a part of the arrest. And whether a report is made to the Virginia State Police. But as a result of the conviction or the entry into the program, whether it's a local ordinance or the state statute, the Division of Motor Vehicles is going to be notified.
If they're not in a car, do they have to be notified?
Absolutely. Yes, ma'am.
Why?
Because that's the law of Virginia.
Really? So
it is just
the
law
of
Virginia.
A punishment no matter what you know, whether or not a car is involved, you're going to have...
It is a consequence of possessing that substance in the Commonwealth of Virginia in this day and time.
And we have to do that? Or under a local ordinance, do we... We don't have a choice of that not being part of the consequence? If it's a class 4 misdemeanor...
I don't think city council has any choice.
But a class 4 misdemeanor, if we declare it that also involves DMV?
the court is required to notify DMV, and that's completely out of your control.
Yeah, even if it's a class four?
Yes. Yeah. They report all offenses that have license ramifications to the Division of Motor Vehicles, and they don't have any choice about it.
So you're saying it has a license ramification because it's a drug, not because it's a particular kind of charge?
Whether it's an ordinance-based prosecution or a state law-based prosecution, DMV would still be notified.
Because it's a drug, not because it's a certain class of misdemeanor?
That's correct. Okay. It's because of the substance.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ms. Gellerin, do you have any questions?
No.
I also have a question about quantity. We're talking about a class four misdemeanor for a simple possession. Is there a quantity associated with that that is unavoidable?
There's a point at which the quantity, a half ounce or greater, creates an inference of possession with intent to distribute. So there is a point at which quantity enters into it.
And that's pretty small, isn't it?
A half an ounce? It's not a large package.
14 grams.
It's not a large package, but it can be very expensive.
And so that's it. After a half of an ounce, our local ordinance applies or doesn't apply if it's 3/4 of an ounce?
That would be a charging decision at the front end of the process.
Okay. Well, and another one of my concerns is, you know, how much discretion is built into this at the arrest point, because that's where we see disproportionality in terms of all of these, you know, in the court, in the judicial system. Or we may. That may be one causative place. So I'm concerned about, well, this might happen or that might happen, and who's deciding what happens to whom? And is that something that is controllable, that we say this is what's going to happen if you are?
Well, it's controllable through the policies and procedures that are implemented by a police department. That's one means by which it's controllable. It's controllable by the approach that's taken in court. And as I said, as night follows day, if people want the program, they get the program. If people want to go and receive the conviction, that's what the court will do.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not entirely sure what the difference is, but what advantage there is to that we're hearing about with this local ordinance, if it sounds like it's like the state law.
It is a practical matter. There really is no advantage, and in fact, it appears there's a distinct disadvantage for many people because it will cut off their access to a restricted privilege to drive if they're convicted under the ordinance that you have in front of you.
With the possible exception of the young woman from Chile, because a lower charge would have meant that she wouldn't have been.
That would be an example of a context in which there definitely is a preferable impact. It would still potentially be at the expense of a privilege to drive, but when you weigh that against the ability to come and go from the country, that's an easy decision to make. That's one context.
That's one case in which it would be, but
yes.
The other's not so much.
Yes.
So can we pass an ordinance that so be, you know, that we see in front of us, but that does not mention a second arrest for that then does not state the second arrest will be a class one misdemeanor? If we just leave that out,
so what? All
I don't know of an impediment from leaving that out. You can do that.
Well, and then a second arrest would be what?
Well, it
be
might
a class
be charged
four?
Under
would it be
state
a class
law.
Four?
Yeah, I mean, there'll be a record of the conviction, and someone who is perceived to have a problem could be on a second encounter charged under state law. I mean, there are all kinds of ways to have solutions. Nobody's all that interested in it, frankly.
In what?
In this is not a great priority mm-hmm. for law enforcement purposes, making possession cases. I don't know how to stress that more significantly. It is
yet the consequences of losing your license and you're the charge that you're convicted with and potentially going through this, as you noted, a really rigorous program that you have to pay for, is that serious?
And there's some reasons why that is. One is we're in the state we're in. And different areas of the state are far more conservative than our area. Mm-hmm. There's also a basis in the law that's related to the frequency with which people might be consuming substances of this sort and be behind the wheel, just as they might with alcohol. And that's part of the law, to try and prevent or deter people from doing that. I also have a different vantage point in this. My wife's a middle school teacher, has been for more than 30 years. And for people to see young people with the frequency with which we do consuming substances, it's important not to encourage that in any respect. And I understand everybody here is seeking to do that. And from my own unique perspective, I see pre-sentence report after pre-sentence report where people who have been perhaps less successful academically or are comparatively low-skilled begin the consumption of substances of abuse, and it doesn't matter if it's marijuana or alcohol or any other substance, at an early age, 12, 13, 14. They are rendered so much more readily subject to addiction in their later life and not that much later life when you have early onset of substance abuse. And this is one of the substances that is counted among that.
But keeping it illegal has not kept it away from the children. And I agree with you in that, but...
That may be completely true, and I don't know that the jury is in on that. There are many people who teach their children about what to do and what not to do with reference to the law. It really does go on in our, even our city.
Well, anyway, we could debate that, but we're, it's, again, I would like to see whatever we can do as to be as liberal towards in the direction
Mayor Hoosier, may we have a point of order here? Because I think these are for questions for Mr. Chapman.
Yeah.
We're entering into a debate.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Now, the only thing I would add, and it has nothing to do with policy behind the law, just very technical issues. Before you adopt an ordinance, get an answer to the questions that are less than certain right now, because they have real ramifications for the people in the community.
And those are, could the language of 18.2251 be applied to a local ordinance? Can we work with the DMV so that they wouldn't necessarily, so that you could have that?
Can we have certainty from the DMV through the Attorney General whether they would for sure take a license based on a local ordinance
conviction? Or whether they could have that modified license?
Yes. Those are the two central questions from my perspective. Because the reality is, whether you're under the state law or under the local ordinance, it's not going to be doing anything really different than what we already do in court. That's the reality.
Other questions? Comments?
We're all ready to comment. Dee Dee, you were in the middle of yours.
Yeah, no, I would just like to see whatever we can do to move as close as we can to making this a very low impact offense, since we have no option to go to legalization, and to try to prevent these consequences for what is a very minor offense that, quite frankly, make the victim of the charge more likely to have difficulties in life, like taking driver's license. I mean, you might as well shoot people in the kneecaps if they're trying to work and pay their fines and et cetera. But so whatever we can do, and it's not clear to me what that
other
is.
Other comments?
I'm basically an abolitionist in that I think that there are very few things for which people are benefited by going to prison at all. I think that for most nonviolent crimes, prison is not the right answer. I think that, you know, and so to me, this is a chance to kind of look at one particular thing to say, you know, is there a place where we can look at keeping people out of jail? I think what I've seen is that as the ordinance before us is currently written, there wouldn't be any difference at all because that's what we already have with first-time offenders. And my concern, actually, with the language that Mr. Fogel brought before us today, with the accused may elect to proceed instead under provisions of the other one so that they could get free legal services, to me just seems like a way to have a two-tier justice system where poor people end up with jail time and well, people who can afford lawyers don't. And so that, to me, is not the solution to this issue. I'm inclined to pause and ask for this Attorney General's opinion. I think that that's something that makes sense to me. As it is, as the ordinance is here now, it's not something I feel is compelling enough to mess with if it's not going to actually improve things.
I'll be willing to say something now, and I'm sure I'm going to be somewhat of the minority opinion on this, but I want to bring another perspective on this, and that is looking at the existing criminal justice system that we have and how it's been dealing with the issue of marijuana and substance abuse, because one thing I do have to thank Mr. Fogel for is that it made me really burrow deep into what we are doing so that I can see that we're following best practices in many, many ways in our regional criminal justice system. And let me kind of review a few things, if I may. And I do want to also underline that the reason why I first even entertained revisiting the sentencing issue was because I did want to make sure that people were getting drug treatment, not going to prison. I do think that marijuana is a drug, and it's something that can become addictive. We have just received word from one of our mental health professionals today that it is very much, for many individuals, addictive. So it's not something to be viewed lightly. In fact, I believe it was Netherlands, which is really beginning to reconsider whether or not they should be closing their marijuana shops as opposed to opening more of them. So I also want to point out that I wanted to make sure that the low-risk offenders were not being put in a pool of high-risk offenders, and I want to make sure that we were spending our law enforcement dollars wisely and using best practices. So in light of those concerns and in light of this ordinance discussion, I did come across in a very important report by the NAACP called Over-Incarcerate and Under-Educate, and it was put out in 2010. And they had 11 principles to follow in order to address and cause a paradigm shift in your criminal justice system so that you were really investing in an alternative diversion away from prison, which seems to be the other theme that's very strong here. We're concerned about people of color, people who are indigent, getting put in prison when they really need to have substance abuse treatment and a mental health care. So with that, I used it almost as a rubric, their 11 principles. And I went and took that rubric and talked to OAR, the Offender Aid and Restoration Office, and probation, as well as our criminal justice planner and our human resources director. So the first thing you're supposed to do when you're wanting to make sure you have a progressive evidence-based program for your criminal justice system is that you study the problem. We just already approved our payment to be a partner with the Disproportionate Minority Contact and Juvenile Justice Task Force efforts to reduce the disparities. And we're also currently looking at data with regards to the adult system to do a similar evaluation. The next step is to look at creating reinvestment commissions. We have a justice reinvestment project in our Charlottesville-Albemarle regional system that is looking precisely into identifying legislative and policy avenues to downsize prisons, prison populations, and shift savings from prison to other priorities. We have a One Less initiative executed by the evidence-based decision-making project policy team, of which Mr. Chapman is a member, as well as our own police chief, Longo. And they use evidence-based decision-making. They turn interaction within the criminal justice system into an opportunity. That's a goal. And they operate collaboratively with all the agencies in both city and county. This is one of seven seat sites in the entire U.S. We're pretty unique in how we approach this issue. Are we using our monies wisely? Are we putting low-risk people into a high-risk population? Are we diverting them from prison and giving them the care they need? Eliminating disparities in drug laws. I mean, the big issue nationwide has been crack and powder cocaine. President Obama dealt with that in August 2010. There isn't that issue of any kind of sentencing discrepancy in marijuana. And again, when I look at the evidence, when they are found with simple possession, they are given the choice. They can go with a deferred judgment. At that point, they are undergoing treatment. They will then not have that on their record. In talking to our professionals, I find out that a lot of them are college students that opt to do that. And I'm reminded of the discussion we had with regards to the noise ordinance not too long ago about how having a threat of a severe fine and possible even jail time was enough to make a lot of the fraternities turn around and assist our police department to work with the neighborhoods to limit the noise. So we understand with certain populations, in this case this was a college population, they were interested in not having that on their record. So is the question then the race of the people that haven't chosen that route, or is it the race of the college kids? If we don't have enough minorities in the college population, shouldn't we be working on that as the issue, not looking at the fact that many of the people that are then recidivating in marijuana use, there's also other tendencies to other kinds of criminal behavior. It's not just marijuana. So second, third, and fourth encounters with the law, it's not only with regards to marijuana. There's a penchant for criminality. That's what I've been told. So then we increase earned time. That's an issue about allowing prisoners to earn an earlier release by participating in educational and vocational programming as well as drug and mental health treatment. Greg Fairchild from Darden School has developed a pilot, an educational vocational program about that. Mr. Robert Johnson of Region 10 also stated that marijuana fits the categories of drugs that are used, abused, and for certain individuals can be addictive. Yet again, the proponents of both all the three different ordinances now we have before us have said that it's harmless and it will curb the black market. That has not been substantiated. The fifth point in the NAACP comprehensive approach is to support youth violence reduction programs. We have a gang awareness task force, which recently got a $35,000 grant to study gang behavior. And again, we have that we're funding the efforts of the Disproportionate Minority Contact and Juvenile Justice Task Force. The sixth point, reform sentencing and drug policies. Again, that's talking about eliminating mandatory minimum sentencing. But what I have discovered is the first-time offenders under our current marijuana ordinance do not get incarcerated. They have a choice. There is an elective treatment and diversion program that removes the charge. By creating a local ordinance that conflicts with our state ordinance, we might be guilty of the law of unintended consequences. So, again, I'm very, very, very nervous about tampering with something that might, in fact, remove some legal rights to individuals. use diversion for drug-involved individuals. We're using diversion for marijuana via the OAR's deferred judgment program, and for felonies, there's drug court. Shortening prison terms. This is directly related to some of the work of the Justice Reinvestment Project. Increased parole release rates. Again, this is the One Less initiative being executed by the evidence-based decision-making project policy team. Reduce revocations of people under community supervision. That's developing alternatives to incarceration. That's, again, a topic of the Justice Reinvestment Project. Supporting reentry. There are reentry efforts at the jail, the inmate work program, and a regional reentry council. Our council has expanded the reentry apprentice program through the Parks and Rec. And we have, as a council, submitted as part of our legislative package support for House Joint Resolution number 535 that would allow the restoration of voting rights to a greater number of persons disqualified due to a felony. So in conclusion, of the 11 points that I found in that NAACP report, we are working very well and very hard to create a just system. And dealing with one small ordinance is a little bit like the tail wagging the dog, and it may very well not do what everyone wants it to do. So I cannot support the proposed new ordinance with or without teeth. I don't think it's necessary to divert first-time offenders because we're already doing that. We provide education and treatment. It could unintentionally create more harm than good because it'll be out of sync with our state law, and we do not understand. No one here understands the implications. It would signal that marijuana use is harmless instead of promote treatment, education, and opportunity. It ignores the good work being done by our regional criminal justice network. And the council's legislative package request this year already asked the Virginia General Assembly to reexamine the laws concerning marijuana possession. So I think we've already done what's prudent under the law and is what's recommended by such groups as the National NAACP. And while Virginia's General Assembly is looking over its legislative package from all different localities in the state, we'll be able to see and listen and watch about the success and failure of other states that have legalized marijuana. And I believe we can also take some, learn some lessons from countries like the Netherlands, who are, in fact, revisiting their very, very liberal marijuana policies.
Other comments and questions?
This is a sort of a bizarre conversation we're having because we're, you know, figuring out on the local level, or some of us are trying to figure out on the local level how we make marijuana illegal locally in a way that's going to send a signal that we don't think it's as serious an issue as the state might. But frankly, if I could wave a magic wand, we legalize it locally. We can't do that, though. So in the absence of clear authority to simply legalize or decriminalize it locally, I do think that we have heard tonight about some options that we can take, pursue, to send a signal that this is not, in fact, a law enforcement priority, which we've heard from our Commonwealth attorney and we've previously heard from our police chief, that it is not, in fact, a high law enforcement priority. And I feel like our policy and our message should reinforce that and mirror that. And so, for instance, we heard tonight that in many, if not most cases, we already do what New York City, and I'm going to read it in case anybody hasn't heard what New York City just agreed to do last week. This is a paragraph from Mayor Bloomberg's press conference. He said, "Right now, those arrested for possessing small amounts of marijuana are often held in custody overnight. We're changing that. Effective next month, anyone presenting an ID and clearing a warrant check will be released directly with a desk appearance ticket to return to court. It's consistent with the law, it's the right thing to do, and it will allow us to target police resources where they're needed most." That seems to me a very simple, common sense thing that we can do to send a signal that this isn't a good investment of our police resources. So I would urge council tonight to take action to adopt that as official city policy. Number two, I had a question for Mr. Brown. In your proposed ordinance, you had as a first violation that there would be a fee of $250. Can you tell us where that number came from?
Up to $250. That's the state has four classifications of misdemeanors, and a class four misdemeanor is punishable by fine of up to $250.
Okay, I thought it was 500. Is that not correct?
That's class three misdemeanor.
Okay.
And the proposal that was made to you from the original ordinance submitted by Mr. Fogle made it a class four misdemeanor.
Right. I think in your memo you had it at, well, anyhow. So can a locality essentially say, because state law allows a fine of up to X number of dollars, could the locality set that fine lower?
Well, that's what the proposal is.
No, I'm saying, could we say, for instance, that we're only going to fine somebody $25 if they're caught for a first-time offense?
I wouldn't endorse any ordinance that was inconsistent with state law.
I'm sorry, you?
I would not endorse any ordinance that was inconsistent.
Well, I'm asking if it's consistent. The state law says it should be a fine up to X number, $250. If we say as a matter of policy that in Charlottesville the fine's only going to be $25 or $5 or 50 cents or whatever it is,
if
as a way of sending a signal that this, well, go ahead.
Are you saying that would be in the ordinance, or that would just be a policy? I mean, generally up to the judge to decide the amount of the fine.
We don't control.
It sounds like you're kind of creating a new class of misdemeanor.
Well, no, I'm saying that I'm asking for your legal opinion. I mean, I read state law to say there should be a fine of up to X number of dollars, $250 for a class four misdemeanor, and I'm saying in our local ordinance, $50 or $25 is in that range. It's up to $250.
Right. I guess I'm asking whether you want the ordinance to say
the
that.
The local ordinance, yeah, that's what I'm asking.
To say a fine of no more than $5.
Right now it says $250.
I think the question is,
it's no longer.
Do we have the authority to tell the judge how much under $250 it is?
No. In my opinion, you don't.
Okay.
Does it have to be a misdemeanor? Do we have the authority to? I mean, I'm just wondering if you know, to make a fine of $25 is no longer a misdemeanor. I take it.
You're asking, can you decriminalize it? No.
That's what that means.
Yeah, we know we can. No, that's a good question. All right. So let me continue on my list. So I think I would like to see us adopt the local ordinance. I would like to see us enter in an agreement with the public defender's office that we would essentially contract with them or provide financial support for them in exchange for representing anyone who's prosecuted under the local ordinance. Give them an option to have defense, legal defense. I'd like to see us petition for a clarification on the DMV policy. I think. If we're being realistic, that the idea that, you know, we're expecting Ken Cuccinelli as our Attorney General to give the green light to liberalizing marijuana laws, I don't see that happening. And so I think that will be a path towards inaction. But I do think if we can work on clarifying what the DMV policy would be regarding a violation of a local offense versus a state offense would be good. And I do think Mr. Fogle made an excellent point in his comments today and previously about shifting the whole way we approach drug possession from a criminal matter, particularly marijuana possession from a criminal matter, to a public health matter, and taking a really hard look at resources that are available locally or not available locally for drug rehab, because we know they're lacking, particularly and alcohol rehab for that matter. But so I think if we can do these things, adopt the New York policy about interdictions, adopt a local ordinance, funding for the public defender to allow individuals prosecuted under local ordinance to have access to legal counsel, petition for a clarification on the DMV policy, and then a real hard look at drug rehab and alcohol rehab in our community. Those things, I think, they're all baby steps, but I think they would move us in the right direction.
All of you had a chance to speak. Let me make a few comments. This is a very passionate issue for many people, and it affects many lives of young people as well as old people. And it is a issue of not only legal aspects, but also the policy issue for which we can influence to some limited degree. It seems to me that under present situation, we are not incarcerating in Charlottesville anybody on the first offense. And I think by trying to fool around with the legislation, you will endanger the situation and improve the situation, in my mind. You lose the legal services which are available now under state law. It will have a question of licensing is important. They'll lose that. It is our administrative policy at this time not to prosecute first-time marijuana offender for jail. And I think that is a good policy and it should continue. And I feel that no valid purpose is going to be served by changing the ordinance at this time. Actually, you'll lose some of the privileges you have instead of you gain. And so I'll be opposed to this.
I would like to just put before our police chief for kind of future consideration the New York policy. I think if it is something that our police support, I think it would be a good policy for us to do. I think for us to do it tonight would be premature, having not kind of taken that step. But I think that sounds like something that probably already is our policy, and we might want to codify that.
Or it's our practice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It is our practice. So are there motion to deal with this issue?
Mayor Hooja, I'd like to make one more comment, and that in light of the fact that we all seem to agree that we would need more discussion and understanding of the need for greater public health and substance abuse counseling, and that we also have a very willing criminal justice network of professionals that want to meet and engage with this council to discuss future policy, especially in light of the pending expansion of the jail, and we might very well need a good discussion with our community stakeholders, with our mental health and public health officials, and our criminal justice professionals. And let's have a really engaged work session end of the spring and the summer as we kind of move towards making investments in, say, our prison system, when we would really need to be investing in treatment and educational alternatives. So I would like to propose that.
I'm not necessarily opposed to work session, but I think that, as you mentioned in your talk, that that's already happening in the community, and rather than forcing all those folks to come to our work session, it might be better if we kind of individually go to those meetings.
Well, they suggested this is a way to have a thorough engagement.
Mm-hmm. Are there any motions this evening?
I'd like to ask if we can direct staff to speak to the police chief and to see if this is a policy that seems, you know, that could actually come from staff, that might be something we would consider. Sure. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with asking for an attorney general's opinion on those two issues. I think that it might serve to kind of pave long-term, you know, way for eventual things all over the Commonwealth. So
I agree with Mr. Norris. It's a total waste of time, well, given who's going to give your opinion.
I won't push it because I do know who the attorney general is.
I would be in support of the idea of our administrative policies talking to our police people and court people.
I missed your last statement.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Right.
To talk to the police and the Commonwealth Attorney to institutionalize this policy we are already doing. Is there any other motion?
Well, I'm going to move that we approve. I may not get a support for it, but I'm going to move that we adopt the language proposed by Mr. Fogel.
Which the public has not seen.
Actually, I'm not even sure I support the one that he's proposed tonight, because I do think it's a little unwieldy. I think his original proposal was very clean and very simple, which makes marijuana a misdemeanor, a class four misdemeanor. And that we, in order to address the inequities in access to legal counsel, that we agree to contract with the Public Defender's Office.
So you're moving the first version?
That's
correct.
Do
you want to read it so that we know what I think?
Actually, I don't have Mr. Fogel's first version on me, except I have.
I don't, but that too, the public has not seen.
Right, this way okay. It would be easy enough.
Is there a second to the motion?
Well, I will second it if we can read it out loud, because I think the public needs to.
I just want to ask a question. Everyone is confident and understanding of the consequences of passing this local ordinance.
Well, it hasn't passed yet.
No. I'm asking the question.
I think we understand.
Maybe rhetorical, but.
So, does somebody have a copy of the, Mr. Fogel, do you have a copy of your original ordinance?
He's looking.
First one you sent to us.
I have it, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Would you please read that, Mr. City Attorney?
A, it is unlawful for any person knowingly or intentionally to possess marijuana unless the substance was obtained directly from or pursuant to a valid prescription or order of a practitioner while acting in the course of his professional practice or except as otherwise authorized by the Drug Control Act, Virginia Code Section 54.1-3400 at SEC. Upon the prosecution of a person for violation of this section, ownership or occupancy of the premises or vehicle upon or in which marijuana was found shall not create a presumption that such person either knowingly or intentionally possessed such marijuana. Any person who violates this section shall be guilty of a Class 4 misdemeanor. B, the provisions of this section shall not apply to members of state, federal, county, city, or town, law enforcement agencies, jail officers, or correctional officers as defined in Virginia Code Section 53.1-1, certified as handlers of dogs trained in the detection of controlled substances when possession of marijuana is necessary for the performance of their duties. C, the provisions of Virginia Code Section 18.2-251 relating to probation and dismissal for first offenders under certain conditions shall be applicable to a first offense under this section.
Okay. Is it the motion you're making, Mr. Norris?
That is the motion I'm making. I would add a provision about providing access to public defender through a contract the city enters into with the public defender's office.
Is it the motion you're seconding?
I'll second.
Any discussion on the motion? I have already mentioned to you that I plan to vote against motion of this nature because I think it will do more harm than good. Any other
points?
Shall we vote? No, it is the first reading.
Oh, first reading. Well, in that case, I'll also say that I would not support it.
And I would not support it for reasons I've already stated.
Okay. Thank you.
I do think there is agreement, though. We got at least the majority of councilors agreed
Absolutely.
To pursue
yes.
the policy.
Institutionalizing the policy.
Yes, I think there's agreement on that. Next item.
I fully agree with Ms. Galvin's request or suggestion of a work session to look at resources for treatment, look for resources for rehabilitation. I think that has to be part of the puzzle, so
yes,
thank you.
I agree.
Just to kind of clarify it, the reason that I would oppose that policy is because I think it does do more harm than good. I think that we would either create a two-tier system or we would have people who are being punished unjustly by being stuck with things like no driver's license who would not have those penalties if they were prosecuted under current law.
Any other comment on this issue?
Well, seeing where the votes are, I do, even though I don't know how much fruit it will bear, I wonder if it is you know, worth trying to get some clarification on whether these provisions could apply to a local ordinance, whether the DMV provision could apply for to a local ordinance.
Is there any reason that we can't ask for that opinion from the Attorney General?
You could certainly request an opinion from the Attorney General. And bear in mind, one of the answers may be to call into question your authority to do this at all.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, that'll give us part of an answer.
That's the risk you run.
All right.
Well, I'm not sensing there's support for it anyway, but if the Attorney General were to come back and say you could do it, then maybe that would get us a third vote.
It would give us the knowledge we
need. You're a dreamland. I would say you live in... Okay.
I think so just as a point of order, if that was a first of two readings, does that mean we have to go through all this again, or are you withdrawing your motion?
There's clearly not a third vote for
no.
it.
But I think you only need two for a first reading.
I know, but her question is it worth even proceeding knowing that we're not going to get a third vote on it? And so I've made my motion. It's been seconded for the record. But if there's no chance of getting a third vote on it, I'd just as soon pull it so that we can explore some of these other avenues.
I think that'll be better.
Thank you.
Then, and again, if the Attorney General comes back and says that we can apply those provisions locally, then maybe we'll get a third vote.
Okay, thank you. Next item on the agenda is